Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Emma Renee During of the Rural Organizing Project. Welcome, Emma. Can you tell us more about your organization?
Hi, thanks so much for having me. My name is Emma, and as Julie said, I work with the Rural Organizing Project. And Rural Organizing Project, or ROP, is made up of over 75 autonomous and volunteer-run groups across the state of Oregon that are all working to advance human dignity and democracy. And that looks different in every county and every city, but we're all kind of working together and moving in the same direction.
So you say this is a rural organizing project. Is it nationwide or an Oregon initiative?
Nope, we're just in Oregon. Sometimes we cross over the state borders a little bit, but we focus on Oregon specifically.
Cool. This is for a rural organizing project. Do you work with urban groups? And if so, is that different? And why are you focused where you are? Why rural?
Yeah, so in 1992, 30 plus years ago, there was an anti-queer ballot measure number 9 that was being put forward by an out-of-state group, or paid for by an out-of-state group, I should say. And they were trying to put homophobic language in the Oregon Constitution. And there was a campaign to oppose that called No on 9 that was based in Portland. And they decided that they were going to focus on Portland Metro, you know, Salem, kind of that short I-5 corridor of urban Oregon. And groups all across the state that were not in that small corridor said, oh, this is impacting me. I see people collecting signatures for this ballot measure when I go to the post office. My neighbors are talking about it, and I want to do something. I want to speak out about how I'm not in support of this measure.
Right.
And so those groups started just kind of doing their own thing, fixing their own problem at the local level, and then started to connect with one another. And when multiple of these groups, as the story goes, obviously, or not obviously for your listeners, I am not 30 plus years old. I was not around then. I've been with ROP for just 5 years. But those groups kind of called up the No on 9 campaign and said, hey, I'm in Scappoose. Hey, I'm in Cottage Grove, you know, wherever they're calling from. I would love to be part of this campaign. And the campaign said, cool, yeah, you could come door knock with us in Portland. You could come volunteer in our urban areas, or
right.
You could send a check. And they were like, no, that's not what we're interested in. And ended up getting connected to one another, partially through one of our founders, Marcy Westerling. And they worked together on that campaign. We won.
Nice.
Measure 9 was voted down. But people immediately we're like, this is not the last time we're going to need these connections. And so we had the first rural caucus and strategy session that year in 1992. And that was this convening of these leaders that had been working together on the No on 9 campaign. And they decided in that statewide convening that they needed an organization to hold them together and to continue to keep those relationships intact, and also support all of the groups in moving in unison and moving and exercising their collective power. And so we've held a rural caucus and strategy session every year since then. This year's caucus is on April 6th. It's a Saturday. It's going to be in Woodburn this year. It's in a different part of the state every year. And we're super excited to see what the coming year will hold. And that space is really to set the direction for the year to come. Since the very beginning, when the direction was, let's start an organization. But every year since, the groups gather together and decide. Some of it is just like, oh, you have this cool story. I want to take that home and work on that where I live. And some of it is, oh, this is a statewide issue, or this is a challenge that we're all facing, and let's take it on together.
Well, it's so fascinating to me because I'm from Montana, but I've been living on the East Coast for 30 years. And when we decided where to move to, and we could go anywhere, we wanted to go to Oregon. I was surprised when people think of Oregon, from my perspective, coming from out of state, you think of Portland and you think of the coast and you think of green. And it was a surprise to a lot of people I talk about that they don't realize that Oregon has high plains country and not exactly desert, but it's quite a diverse state. And of course, where I came from, everyone thought Oregon was very, very liberal. And you know, Oregon is a lot, you know, Portland is in some of the big towns, but it's very varied. You know, rural people are rural people all over the country. And so everybody thinks of Portland when they think of Oregon, and it's much more than that. What is your background and what attracted you to being with this organization?
Yeah, so I was born in Salem. My family moved to Salem right before I was born. And I grew up with a lot of peers that had that perception of Oregon, like, oh, it's the coast and it's Portland. But my family, almost every weekend, it felt like, from my like kid perspective, we were going somewhere new. And so I got to see the Steens Mountains and we went to Lakeview and we went down the coast. And oftentimes, my family is very motivated around like being outside and going on hikes and that sort of thing. So I wasn't necessarily meeting a lot of people across the state, but I had this real deep love for all the diversity, especially biological diversity at that point, or ecological diversity of the state, and saw that in school, a lot of my peers were like, oh, this is Oregon. Like, it's green and mossy, and didn't necessarily have that statewide perspective. Even, yeah, I think I was really like grew up with this sense of adventure and really appreciate that from my parents. But I graduated high school and said, I want to get as far away as possible. And so I went to college in Vermont. And pretty much as soon as I left, I was like, oh man, I miss home. I miss Oregon. This is such a beautiful state. And so there's so many incredible people. And I learned kind of about organizing and how people are making change with people power when I was in college, and really wanted to bring that home and find ways to contribute to my community here in Oregon. And so my first summer out of college, I worked for this group called Oregon Climate that now is called Our Climate, I believe. They changed their name and focus, but we were working on this specific climate policy. And I was interning in Portland. A lot of their volunteers were in Portland. They had some folks in southwestern Oregon in like Jackson County too, but it was a lot of Portland and a lot of going to Salem and lobbying kind of stuff. And I was just not that into it. No shame on that organization, but I was like, this is not all of the state. I want to be working truly statewide and getting to work with folks across the state. And so at the end of the summer, I got to plan this trip across kind of the northeastern band of the state. We went along 84 from the gorge to Baker City and stopped in maybe different places and met some people that I had just like found randomly online, like, you might be interested. And I love the trip. I loved getting to meet them, but I really didn't like that I was coming in saying, here's this thing that you should do. You should sign on to this specific policy. Because some of the groups we were meeting with were super excited about that policy and it really aligned with their priorities. And some groups were like, yeah, that's just not our focus right now. Like, you do you, but that's not what we're into. And I wanted to be like, cool, so what are you into? Let's work on that. And so when I found out that about ROP and the way that it's led from the grassroots or from the people on the ground that are facing directly the challenges of rural Oregon, and those folks on the ground are setting the direction and choosing their own priorities, and the statewide organization that kind of holds folks together is asking, what do you need? How can we support you? And how can we support one another? I was like, sign me up. When do I start? I wanted to be part of that as soon as I could.
Oh, cool. You just mentioned really briefly, you said the challenges of rural Oregon. Talk to me about that. What are the challenges of rural Oregon? And how is it different from Portland's challenges? And I'm sorry to keep dragging Portland's name into it, but that's a town everybody knows. What are the challenges of rural Oregon?
Yeah, I mean, I work exclusively in rural, so it feels hard to compare to what is going on in Portland because I honestly spend very little time there. I maybe go once a year tops, and just like hang out with a friend that I have there. So I don't know how much I can compare, but I can say that there are real challenges that rural Oregon is facing, and a lot of that comes from, I would say, lack of funding and disinvestment in our communities. I'm excited to share some of the successes that we've had over the past decades, but I think right now housing is a huge challenge that communities are facing. There's a lot of people who are not able to afford a place to rent or to buy, and it's impacting schools being able to hire people. It's impacting local small businesses, county government, all across the board. It's been really hard for people to find housing, keep housing, and stay in rural communities. Find jobs that will pay enough that they can find a house and have find a house that
Right.
is not being rented or not being like rented as a short-term rental for Airbnb or whatever the case
Right.
may be. So housing is a huge one. One piece that we work on a lot is creating, making sure that our communities are welcoming to immigrants and refugees, because there are a lot of ways that I guess there's a couple different issues that are going on with that, but a lot of our community resources that do exist are not enough for anybody. And we're trying to build that. And also there are ex added barriers if you don't have citizenship or you don't speak English,
Right.
or you maybe came and don't read any language because you didn't have access to education before arriving here. So we do a lot of work in supporting immigrants and refugees to be able to fully participate in our communities. Rent, what else? I was talking to somebody yesterday who is super concerned about internet access, food access.
Technology, yeah.
The umbrella of human dignity and democracy that we work under is really broad, but sometimes I think it's helpful to define what we mean by democracy, because a lot of folks, we say, oh, or you, the USA is a democracy, but like, what does that actually mean?
Right.
And so the ways that we define it are based on the World Book Encyclopedia, which seems like should be a pretty standard definition, but those are inclusion of all and equality for all, majority rule, minority rights, a basic standard of living for all people, and an informed public that participates in the democratic process. Those are the four key pillars of democracy that we look at. So I've just mentioned like a basic standard of living is really kind of what building, making sure people have access to housing, access to food, access to, in this day and age, the internet is part of a basic standard of living when it's required to be able to sign up to get a vaccine or sign up to have an appointment with whoever. Roads. I was just trying to go to Brookings last week. Weeks ago, and the two main roads going into Brookings are pretty unreliable. One gets shut down regularly, the other one is one way because of a landslide, and they haven't fixed it in like 6 months. There's just basic infrastructure in our state that really, really needs to be built up and built up better. And that goes kind of across the board from roads to school buildings to libraries to, reliable utilities, internet access, but also kind of those softer pieces of where do people reach out for support? Who can they call on to figure out how to navigate the structure? Sometimes there is funding for housing, but nobody knows how to get it. So I could keep going on for a long time, but I'll stop there for now.
Can you characterize to me people of rural Oregon? I'm sure you can't put them all in a slot and describe who they are, but you had mentioned something about democracy being a majority rule but minority rights. Could you explain more about that? How does that work together then?
Sure, yeah. So I think majority rule means that when we vote in elections, the person or the ballot measure that gets the most votes wins. And that's a basic pillar of democracy. Minority rights means that we also have a Bill of Rights. We also have a constitution, and there are checks and balances on the system. So you can't just vote in a ballot measure that says no state support can go to queer people, as in the example of Measure 9. So there's rights that need to be maintained for all people in our democracy, even if the majority, like in that case, people that are heterosexual, vote against that, we're not going to discriminate against anybody in our community. So more recently, there's been some ballot measures, statewide ballot measures that were saying, majority rule just isn't good enough. If we want to pass a tax measure, we're going to have to pass it by 66%, or it's going to have to be like a larger than majority number. And we said, no, that's not how democracy works. We don't agree with this. We think that majority rule means majority rule, and that's 50%. In the case of minority rights, in another staying in the ballot measure land, there's so many examples. I'll start with Measure 105, which I believe is in 2018, that was trying to take away Oregon's statewide law that said law enforcement can't work with ICE. So since the 80s, Oregon said law enforcement can't use state or local public resources to fund or support this multi-billion dollar agency that is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Or at the time, it was INS, Immigration and Naturalization Services. And so in 2018, folks tried to take that ballot measure away, which would have an impact on small group of people in our state, which would be people that don't have documentation. And lots of folks, including lots of our peers, came out and said, no, on 105, we want to keep our sanctuary state law. And not only do we want to keep it, but in 2021, we went further and we actually expanded the state law with a policy called the Sanctuary Promise Act that filled loopholes and clarified some of the language in the 1980s law and created a hotline so that people who are impacted by ICE detention or have concerns that local law enforcement is continuing to take those precious public resources and put them towards this federal agency that, again, has billions of dollars. That people can call this hotline and report, like, hey, this is not going well. We need some support around here, and get financial assistance right off the bat. If they're detained or their family members detained, they can get financial assistance, which is really awesome. And they can also get support in investigating what really went on here.
You mentioned resource limitations. What strategies could ROP use to help people overcome, the resource limitations in rural projects? Like how could they connect people, or what strategies could they bring to bear to get these resources besides connecting people, or tell me how that works?
Well, I think there's a lot of different kinds of resources. So one story that makes me think of is we just turned 30 a couple years ago, and we put this digital exhibit together. You can find it on rop.org/bridgingdivides, which is all one word. But we were looking back at these stories and successes over the last 30 years and lessons that we've learned, partially because we're seeing a lot of the same patterns of scapegoating queer and trans people come up again. They were present in the 90s and we're seeing them again in different ways. But one of the stories specifically around this, like, economic resources, and in this case, food access, was that in 1999, Oregon had the highest rate of hunger in the United States. And this was not a rural specific problem, but it was particularly highly felt in rural communities, partially because of the way that the eligibility requirements were being calculated. So ROP partnered with PICUN, which is Oregon's Farm Worker Union, and also Oregon Center for Public Policy and Oregon Action and others, and all worked together to push the state to make food assistance easier to access for everyday people. And so community leaders first were just kind of like, okay, what's going on? What are the issues with the system? Because we have a lot of hungry people, we want to fix it. And so people would time themselves filling out this 14-page food assistance application. And what they learned, which you can probably guess from hearing that it's 14 pages long, is that it took hours to fill this out. And it was really inaccessible. Even if you were eligible for food assistance, you couldn't fill it out. Like, who has a couple extra hours when they're going hungry?
Right.
So human dignity leaders mailed in hundreds of paper plates representing those going hungry in Oregon to the chair of it was called the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger at the time. And from those hundreds of paper plates, people from all over the state sending in this same message, we won. And Oregon shortened the application to just 2 pages. And after getting that new application, people found you could fill it out over a lunch break. It took less than 30
Right.
minutes. And they also reduced the requirements to qualify and made it more equitable. It made it so that rural counties that previously were being counted incorrectly were included in this emergency food assistance requirement. So we won. And then 5 years after these changes were made, the 2 pages and the reduction in requirements, Oregon's hunger rate had dropped by more than 60%.
Nice.
So that's food resources specifically, and that's an example that is a statewide issue. And I think similarly, just last year, was it, or 2 years ago, the Oregon's governor, Tina Kotek, put out a proposal for housing funding. And the parameters they were using was the like top 10 counties in terms of counties that have unhoused people. But they were counting it as hard numbers, not per capita. And so they were obviously the places with the most unhoused people were the places with the most people, period. So it was Portland and Metro. It was Marion County and I believe Lane County, maybe Deschutes was in there. So like Bend, where I live. And rural counties said, hey, wait a second. This doesn't make sense. We also have a housing crisis. It might look a little bit different, but we also need resources to support people that don't have housing or are about to lose their housing. And from a lot of messages and calls and people making noise, they ended up changing the funding. And is it enough? No. Was the hunger funding enough? It dropped 60%. There's still those 40% that are still going hungry. So there's always more work to be done, but it was a really powerful example of the state government listening to rural when folks kind of united their voices and all said the same thing at the same time. Yeah, and there's obviously not all resources need to come from the state government. Some things are issues on a county level, some things are issues on a city level, and some things we really need the federal government to step in on. And I think housing is one of those examples. We've seen there's some really stark line graphs of federal housing funding since the 70s, really just dropping almost to zero really quickly. And if you line that up in terms of time with the numbers of people that don't have housing, it looks very obvious to me that the federal government cut funding for housing and housing assistance, and people lost housing. And it didn't happen immediately because some of those houses that had been funded previously, people were still able to live in for a certain amount of time. But now, 50 years later, we're seeing houses falling apart. I biked by a house that had their gutter like falling off the house today. And that's not unusual, especially in rural communities, in low-income communities, which rural is on average more low-income than urban areas in our state. So yeah, just to say that it's not all on the state government, there's all of these different interacting governmental agencies, but when it comes to maintaining or getting to a basic standard of living for all people in our democracy, it's really essential that we look at who's missing out and who needs support to be able to get to a place where we can thrive.
Right. And usually those people are a little bit invisible. You know, it's not the obvious people that you see necessarily all the time. So they're hidden. For our guests just tuning in, this is Living Downstream on 99.7 KQUA. I'm your host, Julie Lowe, and we're speaking with Emma Renee Durning of the Rural Organizing Project. Tell me, how do you measure the impact of your rural development projects? Measure it by a win? Or, you know, how do you evaluate your work? And is it
Yeah.
all legislative kind of wins, or is it other kind of numbers or other kind of stories that you can tell?
Absolutely. Yeah, we do a lot of work with goal setting, because it's certainly none of the like critical issues facing our democracy are going to be like a checkbox victory.
Right, that it's done. Right.
Yeah. So, for example, I was mentioning before the Sanctuary Promise Act that we passed in 2021. We were so excited that this law passed that filled loopholes in the previous state law that separates law enforcement from immigration enforcement. And 2 years later, we last winter did a public records request with some partners to see what county sheriff immigration related policies looked like.
Right.
And we found that two-thirds of counties still have policies on the books that are not in compliance with the Sanctuary Promise Act. Some of them are not even in compliance with the 1980s law. So there's a lot of work to be done on that front. One of the things that the Sanctuary Promise Act did was put in what's called a private right of action, which means, in non-legal speak, that anybody can sue if they could have concerns that the law is being broken. So we, as a nonprofit organization, can sue. You, listener, as an individual, could sue. It doesn't have to go through the attorney general's office, which had been what was going on before, and it was really hard to get them to prioritize enforcing the sanctuary law, partially because there's a lot of laws they have to enforce, but also we would like them to take a higher priority or put
Right.
this as a higher priority. So with this private right of action, we were able to sue the Cottage Grove City and Cottage Grove Police Department for violating the Sanctuary Promise Act. We sued them last February, and just last week we won.
Oh,
And
wow.
so the city of Cottage Grove was really great. They took our concerns seriously after hearing from a judge, and we were able to work with them to get a new policy on the books that is awesome. It's the best policy that we could imagine for a local jurisdiction to adopt. And they're taking it really seriously. They're going to have regular trainings for their whole staff team, because the law might change, and they're going to continue to update their team and continue to remind them how to be in compliance with this law. And so we had that victory, and we're super excited about it. Folks in Cottage Grove had been experiencing a lot of racial profiling, particularly Indigenous Guatemalan folks had been experiencing a lot of profiling. And when we announced the lawsuit, folks reported that it had stopped almost immediately.
Wow.
And that continues to this day. People feel a lot more safe going to the courthouse to pay their utility bill, or to report if they get a speeding ticket or a parking ticket or whatever. And people are feeling really good about that particular win. And so, can you measure that as a success? Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
That's a huge success. And what the bigger success will be is that county sheriffs all across the state take note that they could get sued, and so they better change their policies now. We don't want to waste any county's resources going through a lawsuit if they can just update their policies now
Right.
and be in compliance with the state law, and as an added benefit, not be wasting their precious resources supporting a multi-billion dollar agency, as I said before. So there's lots more work to be done. And we've had this really incredible success just last week.
Awesome. I was raised in Montana and I was never interested in politics, or I never paid attention. I figured what went on in DC was DC's problem on the Hill and whatnot, legislation. Didn't have anything to do with my daily life. And I wonder how much that affects real people every day. What goes on in DC? Does it really affect you? Does anyone really care? But when you get these kind of wins and legislation is passed, how do you make sure just the passing of that legislation carries down to the grassroots where they then need to change laws and whatnot? I mean,
Yeah.
I'm sure there's many examples of legislations that's been passed, but nobody's now acted on its passing.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, there's still laws in the books that don't recognize that. How do you, boy, how do you track that? It would seem you'd have to have a watchdog person on every issue.
Well, I think that's the power of having a large volunteer network all over the
Yeah.
state. In every community, there are people that are connected through Rural Organizing Project and certainly other organizations as well, so that we can pass the word more quickly. But ultimately, that is the state's responsibility. And
Right.
I see in Bend, which is not a small town anymore,
Right.
that the state is paying, or somebody's paying for a billboard that's talking about the Oregon Paid Family Leave Act, which is an incredible victory that we won the Oregon Paid Family Leave Act, and people now have access that never had access before to paid leave to support their family, to take sick time, or to have a kid and rest and get to spend time with their kid when they're
Right.
first born. And it's great that they put this billboard up in Bend, where lots of people drive through. It's on Highway 97. I'm sure lots of people are seeing it that maybe have never heard of this bill. And how many communities don't have a billboard, period, let alone a billboard that's paid for by the Oregon Health Authority? So getting information out and distributing it is huge. And it goes back to that pillar of democracy I mentioned before, which is a well-informed public that participates in the democratic process. And one of the key challenges that folks have been working on, at least since 2019, but honestly, quite a lot longer than that, in terms of folks that we work with, is community radio. Because community media stations like KQUA and
Right.
others are crucial to rural communities being able to get the information that they need, have a trusted source for local news. We work with a lot of communities that don't have a newspaper at all, or don't have a newspaper that allows for letters to the editor because it's like an out-of-state corporation that's just kind of putting a paper out and not, and maybe it's Eugene News getting sent to Bandon, and people, it's like irrelevant to their community.
Right.
So, community media has been something that people have been naming for quite a few years as a really crucial piece of a thriving democracy. There's like freedom of the press is a piece of the puzzle, but if you don't have a press at all, then there's no freedom for it,
Right.
right? And so people have taken on building new radio stations or revitalizing existing radio stations as a way to create that sort of community hub where people can go for a trusted source of information, whether that's like in an ice storm, who do you like? Everybody's lost power, but the radio station has a generator and they're up and telling people the latest on, all the repairs that are happening or something like that. Oftentimes, the community radio stations we work with partner with local emergency departments, fire, sheriff, whatever, to be able to get information out in an emergency. But in not an emergency, it's an incredible way to build community. It's an incredible way to get information about legislation that recently passed or about legislation that's being considered that people might want to participate in, saying whether they like or don't like that.
Right.
So yeah, that's another piece of like, how do you measure success when we're seeing newspapers go bankrupt all over the state? But we're
Right.
also building new radio stations. And I was just on the phone with someone from Baker City yesterday who's building KBZR, a new station that's I think like weeks away from being on the air. And she
Nice.
was saying they're so excited they just got an agreement finalized with the schools, and they're bringing students in to do DJ training. And some of the students that they have been working with are just, she can see their eyes light up as they're
Right.
learning about radio, learning about all the sound equipment. Some of them are musicians, so they're like, oh, I want to record my own music. I want to produce music.
Neat.
It's both like such a powerful way to have a vibrant community and to connect with people, and also connect people with kind of all the possibilities of the world. Right? Someone else from that station, when we were first kind of scheming and dreaming about whether to apply for a license, because there's this license window that came out in 2021, was saying that when he was a kid growing up, I think in Baker County, if I remember correctly, he would listen to a radio show from Ireland that was broadcast on the local station. And that just expanded his view of what was possible and how big the world was. So there's so many possibilities about radio. Obviously, I don't need to gush to you, Julie, about radio.
Well,
You're on it already. But that's a piece of communication systems.
but you know, I was new to this whole concept as well. I didn't realize when I started working with Umpqua Watersheds that they had a radio station and it was a community radio station, and that this platform, the station, is open to anyone who would like to come discuss issues that concern, you know, Umpqua Watershed area or Greater Oregon or anything that needs to be a platform to give people a voice. But I had no idea about it. And in fact, by the way, the music is pretty good on the station too. When we don't have interviews going on, I've been enjoying the music. But that's, for instance, something I had no idea about. How would someone find out if they're, could they call your organization or contact your organization to find out if there's a radio station in their area? Like, how does someone start from the beginning, from the bottom, to find out this information?
Well, if you have a radio, you could listen. You could spin the dial a little bit and see who is talking with the real voice on the air. And oftentimes you can kind of tell the difference between community radio and commercial radio just by the number of ads that you're hearing. But you're also welcome to call ROP, where our email is office@ROP.org, and our main website is ROP.org. Welcome to call us 503-543-8417. Again, that's 503-543-8417. And the email is office@ROP.org. There's also a network of community radio stations specifically that's called Oregon Community Media. And they have a website as well. So you can Google them. And we work really closely with them, but they're created by community radio for community radio and do a lot of support for one another in terms of all the like technical and engineering aspects. But they also sometimes co-create programs that then they share out across the whole network. So that's not an extensive or a fully comprehensive list of all the community radio stations across the state, but it does have a bunch, and we're in community with about 20 stations. We were playing a radio show for 2 years over 20 stations that were coming out monthly. But yeah, there's lots of ways to find radio. Feel free to reach out or just tune in and see what you can find on your dial.
We talked about immigration. We talked about housing situation. We talked about LGBT issues. How about what other issues? Are you concerned with literacy and early education and that kind of things?
As I said, there's over 75 groups all over the state. So there are more than 75 issues that people are working on at any one time. The one that I haven't mentioned yet that a lot of folks are eagerly work taking on, I suppose I could say, is civics education and sharing with people how to participate in our democracy, how to get involved at the local level. And thinking of democracy as something that happens 365 days a year. There's voting, which many of us who are over 18 can participate in, that happens once or twice a year, sometimes 3 times if there's a special election for some reason. But there's also every other day. And there's your city government is working for you, your county government is working for you, your school district is working for you. Sometimes you have a library board or a water district or all these different types of government entities. And sometimes it can be confusing to figure out, like, okay, this is a community issue, whether it be housing, whether it be internet or language access, whatever it may be. But who in government is actually supposed to be working on this? Like, who do I call?
Exactly.
And who's going to call me back? And so folks are putting on a couple, doing this in a couple different ways, but putting on civics workshops to share with people what your county government does and what it's responsible for and what your city government does. Because oftentimes people see, like, okay, there's an issue with housing in my city, and they go to the city and the city says, yeah, there's not really anything we can do about that. Because the county government holds, in most cases, the county government holds most of the services for the region, and that includes inside of city limits. To some extent. And of course, it's complicated because it varies depending on where you live. So that's why these groups are saying, you know what we really need is to have a place that people can learn. Okay, I'm concerned about housing. Where do I take that? Is that a question for the county government? Is that a question for the county commissioners, the people that we elect into office? Or is that a question for a department head of the housing department? And so I need to go there. And that's not an elected position, that's a position that's hired. And that
Right.
person is actually around oftentimes, or we would hope they're around for a lot longer than just one specific term of office that an elected official is. So there's the civics education that's going on, and lots of folks are doing that now and will then transition once we get closer to the May primary election
Right.
and the November general election into education about specifically what's on the ballot. And so we put out an election guide every 2 years that talks about the statewide ballot measures and some suggested questions to ask when you're looking at who your local candidates are and considering it as like you're hiring somebody for a job.
Right.
They are then going to be working for you, so you better make sure that they're qualified and ask some good questions. So we put out that newsprint guide. It's called the STAND Guide, which stands for Small Town Actions for a New Democracy. And then local groups across the state order those guides. And if you want to order them, also reach out to us. And sometimes they'll put in their county or their city specific extra information and then distribute those around the state and knock on their neighbors' doors and have conversations about, hey, have you heard that the election's coming up? What issues are you concerned about? What do you think we should prioritize when we're considering candidates? Here's some things that we're concerned about and some things we know about what's on the ballot, just having conversations. And I think it's especially since the pandemic started and people were oftentimes kind of staying home more and not getting out as much, we're needing to relearn these skills about how to talk to one another, how to
Right.
talk to your neighbor who you maybe haven't talked to in a couple of years, or you just kind of wave across the street, but you don't know more. And obviously, in other cases, people know their neighbors super well and they don't have a street across that they see them at. They're like 6 miles apart from one another, but they're relying on each other during fire season or they're relying on each other when they're plowing the road. You know, our communities are very diverse, but reminding each other how to talk to one another, particularly when it comes to issues that are coming up on the ballot, which I think folks are really scared that there's going to be more disagreement than there actually is. I think a lot of people care about their communities and want to see what's best for their kids. How we get there is complicated. And so it's, I think, and lots of folks at ROP think that it's going to take all of us to solve these huge problems that our communities are facing. And so the more we can disagree, while staying in the conversation and
Right.
staying principled and staying not going to the disagreement of like accusing each other of, you know, personal attacks, but saying, no, this is what I think is going to be best for our community. We share these values of having a thriving community, having kids that can fully participate and grow and thrive. And then let's sit down and let's figure out how we get there.
Right. Because there's nobody who's voting against their own kids. You know, we all have those. We all are looking out for the best interests of our kids. The whole takes a village and whatnot is really true, even if your neighbors are seemed opposed to you on issues. Are there any toolkits and whatnot with ROP? Like if someone had a specific issue, like let's say in a radio station, like a toolkit, how do I get a, you know, how do I start producing a radio station, or how do I find funding for? Are there certain toolkits and whatnot?
Definitely. So our website, ROP.org, has a ton of tools and resources on it. We share a lot of stories of how people have taken action in the past in other counties or in other cities. And those would be under updates. And then there's also under resources, specific toolkits. So there's a toolkit on how to put on one of these civics workshops that lots of folks are doing right now. And I don't know if it's posted on our website, but we do have a radio specific fundraising tool because folks have asked for that. So we have lots of tools, and we're also happy to like chat with folks directly if there's a specific question that we don't have a tool around, or get folks. I mean, I'm not the expert on every issue, so
Right.
oftentimes I'm saying, well, that's awesome. I have no idea, but you should talk to Jim, or you should talk to, whoever that I know does know a lot about that issue and get you connected with someone. And maybe you're calling from Roseburg and the person you need to talk to is in Joseph or they're in Burns. But we have this whole statewide network. And so we're able to get folks connected to the people that are working on similar issues. We
Definitely.
also have the majority of our tools are about how to build a strong and healthy group. Because we have seen over the years that one individual is not going to have as much impact as even three people in or sitting in a room together. Both because it's a lot of work to make change, and our democracy is set up that people have power, and so the more people you have, the more power you have. But also because there's safety in numbers, and sometimes in our communities, you don't have any anonymity. And so to stick your neck out as an individual and say, hey, this is an idea that I think is really important, it's possible that it doesn't go so well. And people say, no, you don't know what you're talking about, or they actually think that that's a dangerous idea for the community, whether or not it really is. And so the more people you have behind you, the more power you're going to have, and the more you'll be able to make sure that folks that might try and intimidate you or convince you not to take action realize like, oh, we can't just single out one person and intimidate them into silence at like this. There's 50 people or there's 10 people that are all really committed to this cause, so we better sit down and listen to them. And I think it goes back to this quote that oftentimes is, I think it's attributed to Gandhi, but actually wasn't Gandhi. I don't know. It's something that's real. I keep coming back to is first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. So,
Ah, I love it. Yeah.
and again, I'm sorry for whoever actually initially said that. I don't know your name, and I don't think it was Gandhi, but maybe it was. But oftentimes, if you don't have power in your community and you're trying to make a change that's going to be better for the majority of people, you aren't going to get your way by just saying, hey, please, I think this is a good idea. Would you please consider it, people in power? That doesn't always work. And so getting more people behind you will help you when they realize that they can't ignore you anymore and they start laughing at you. You can say, well, sure, laugh at us, but we're keeping on and we have 15 people and tomorrow it'll be 30 and the next day it'll be 60. And then when they fight you, you have 100 and then you win because they only have 10. And the power of our democracy is that elections are still free and fair. And so we need to defend that to be able to keep doing this work. But we also get to enjoy that privilege of having elections where if you don't like the person that's in power and you have enough people on your side, you can vote them out and you can get somebody better in there.
Have you noticed any emerging issues in the rural community that weren't around, let's say, 20 years ago? Like, is there anything that's really starting to affect the rural community that's new? Trends and whatnot.
In
I
the
mean, I guess
last 20 years,
the houseless, that's a new thing, I would think.
So I think the economic conditions of rural communities have, in the 90s, we won on Measure 9, which was trying to put homophobic language in the Oregon Constitution. We won on a measure that was trying to scapegoat immigrants as well. And both of those measures were run by the Oregon Citizens Alliance, and Oregon Citizens Alliance didn't actually care about queer people. They didn't actually care about immigrants. What they wanted to do was to dismantle civil rights. And so they were using a specific group of people that were a minority to try and pick apart at civil rights. And they were unsuccessful, but what they were successful at was cutting taxes and these economic measures that really defunded our communities. So they limited property taxes, which, if you're struggling to pay your property taxes, that sounds great. And unfortunately, the way that they limited those taxes has had the biggest savings for the wealthiest Oregonians. So the people in the West Hills of Portland, the businesses in like Portland suburbs whose property values have increased by leaps and bounds since the 90s are the ones that are benefiting the most from the limitations on how much property taxes can increase. And those property taxes go to fund our schools. They go to fund our counties. And so our county budgets have gotten gutted. And that then goes towards housing, that then goes towards public health, that then goes towards all the public infrastructure and social services that form that safety net. So when somebody loses their job, there's a support system to help get them back on their feet. And so, as I was saying about housing, those pieces don't, you don't feel the impact overnight. Like if you cut funding for roads, you don't notice the day that the funding is cut. You notice 5 years later when there's 150 potholes, and it just keeps getting worse and worse. And that's the situation that we're in right now. Housing is falling apart, and school buildings are falling apart, and our roads aren't made for the amount of travel that's getting on them right now. And then you add on top of that lack of funding and like refurbishing of existing infrastructure, the pressures of climate change. And in 2020, so many folks experienced the huge wildfires across like central, western, southwestern, northeastern Oregon had huge wildfires that were like increased in intensity because of climate change. And then not the fires themselves would have been horrendous and would have been terrible no matter what. But the unnatural part of that disaster was the lack of funding for emergency response systems. So emergency notifications were not distributed in a way that people actually heard them. People didn't know that they needed to get out because there was no system to let them know, or the system that existed didn't work. And that comes down to state funding. And then after that, the systems to respond and to rebuild haven't been enough either. And particularly people that were living in mobile home parks have been really hit hard by losing homes and then not getting the funding that the support funding that they need to rebuild in the way that people who have non-mobile homes. Immobile homes, I don't know what you call that. And then add on top of that, if you don't have citizenship or you don't have documentation, then it's likely that you were in a rental situation or you owned a home in a way that was not something that you can prove to FEMA, Federal Emergency Management
Agency. Agency.
Agency. People without documentation were hit with like a triple whammy. A lot of folks were living in mobile home parks because that's what they could afford. They didn't have a rental agreement because that would have put them at risk of ICE detention. And so they aren't able to get the emergency support that they need to move back to their communities. And then we're also seeing a lot of rebuilding, and now maybe I'm not even answering the question. But especially along the Mackenzie, along the Santee Am, so much of what's being rebuilt is not affordable rental housing. It's fancy vacation rentals. And so people that lost their rental in the fire aren't able to move back to their communities because the things that are getting rebuilt in their place are not affordable to them to live in. So it's a
This
really
is a
big challenge.
yeah, and a real difficult for your organization too, because the more I think about it, the complexity of your work is that you need to take on challenges before they're necessarily realized in the community. In other words, you have to get ahead of it. Because as you're saying, take away roads, funding for roads, you see the problem 5 years later when the roads have deteriorated, and then people start saying, where's the funding? And that was taken away 5 years ago. In other words, you don't see the result of these decisions sometimes instantly. So you guys almost have to get on front of it a couple years before we see the results of these changes in legislation. That's really tricky.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that is just the more people we have, the more perspectives we have, and so somebody will notice that piece that's missing. But the other part is the democracy 365 kind of idea. Like, we really believe and we're working towards a world where rural communities and rural people have a seat at every table where decisions are being made about us and are part of those systems. And so it's not just that we're knocking on the door outside saying, hey, don't take that road funding away, but that we're part of that discussion of what do we, where do we allocate the budget? Do we put money? We only have so much this year. Do we work on raising taxes so that we have more money? Do we work on getting the federal government to give us the Inflation Reduction Act, which is putting huge amounts of dollars theoretically into rural communities if we can meet the requirements and navigate all the complexities of that? But being part of sometimes boring budgeting conversations and planning conversations and visioning conversations so that it's not just 5 years later, hey, this didn't work out how we wanted it to, but 5 years before saying, what do we want this to look like and where do we want our communities to go?
Can you tell me about the Rural Organizing Fellowship?
The Rural Organizing Fellowship is a project that we've done twice, once in 2018 and once in 2020, where we brought youth leaders from all over the state together to be part of a cohort for about a year. And each time it looked a little bit different, but the goals were really to build the leadership of young people across the state that care about a rural Oregon that can thrive. And to connect folks across the state, so building relationships across different communities. The first fellowship fellows took on an independent project and were paid about 10 hours a week, I believe. And the second fellowship, we ended up taking that requirement out because folks gave feedback that it was difficult to commit to something that was such a part-time project. There were, I think, maybe 20-ish fellows across the two different fellowships, and they're still powerful leaders in their communities. Some of them have moved since then, but I think they're almost all still in the state and doing great things all over. We love staying in relationship to the work they're doing, and some folks are still kind of formally part of ROP through member groups that they started or got involved in, and some are off on other adventures right now, but I'm excited to see kind of where those relationships go.
Yeah, that's fantastic. A wonderful way to get informed and interested and involved and resume information. That's a great opportunity.
Some folks hear the projects that we're working on and might assume that it's all adults that are working on these, but they're not. Some of our member groups are high school groups specifically. And some of our groups are intergenerational and they have young people and older folks and middle-aged people all working together. So the fellowship was one youth-specific program that we worked on, but most of our work is made up of people of all ages. And even before you're able to vote, you are definitely able to go to city council meetings and speak your mind and be part of making your community better, whether that's in radio or with a campaign or knocking on your neighbor's door and telling them that they need to go vote because you can't yet, you know, whatever the case.
Great. Emma, this is great. I learned about you through the grapevine. So this, I hope this program will help extend the grapevine a little bit so other folks know what's available out there. This has been wonderful. Thank you so much. Let me remind our listeners, this has been an episode of Living Downstream, and I'm your host, Julie Lowe. I've been speaking with Emma Renee Durning of the Rural Organizing Project. If you dropped in late or missed any part of this interview or any other interview in our series, you can find past episodes at KQUA 99.7. And thank you for listening.